Okay, it is November 18th, 2025. And puts us right in the heart of November. Does it seem like there's more Christmas focus this year earlier than ever? Because, anyway, thought we had to get through Thanksgiving, but apparently not. We're gonna sit, as I mentioned before we started recording, we'll sit for 20 minutes. If I can s t tell the time, I'm sorry, my one eye has been upgraded and the other one is not, and between the two I am basically incapable of seeing my computer screen clearly. So doesn't matter to you, I hope. I do like to be able to see everybody's name. I have to lean in to see that. So, all right, you guys. Let me get the sitting started, and I'm so just beginning as usual, just settling back into a comfortable and supportive meditation posture and the Buddha doesn't really limit what that could be. It's sitting, standing, walking, lying down. Those are the four. Pretty much covers everything. But typically people are sitting or lying down. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze so that you're turning the attention inward and away from the visual world. You actually don't have to look at the screen while you're meditating. It's another benefit. Just starting with the general awareness of the body, whatever you're able to feel in your body. It might be an overall feeling of being at rest, being still. Or there might be particular sensations that stand out. We're not trying to pay attention to anything in particular as we start, just beginning to bring the focus together, to bring it into this nonverbal realm of the sense world. And along with that awareness, to relax the body a bit, see if you can release any tension or have a sense of letting go. Even when we aren't actually feeling stressed, we'll often find that there are points of tension or tightness in the body. Sometimes we just carry these tensions with us without awareness. Sometimes you might want to soften the face, the jaw, relax the hair, let the shoulders release. And particularly to soften the belly. So take a couple of breaths where you're aware of letting the stomach expand. Again, that's one area where we can clench the muscles unconsciously. And when we intentionally release, there can be a more general release in the nervous system, kind of feel a settling. And then just letting the attention come to rest on the breath. Here we're bringing more intentionality to the focus of feeling the breath either at the nostrils or the belly. Not trying to control the breath or create any particular experience. Just develop mindfulness, undistracted, non-judgmental awareness. So if you're following the breath at the nostrils, just be aware of the touch of air coming in and out. You're following the breath at the belly, bringing awareness to that movement, rising and falling. It's natural for the mind to wander when we try to pay attention to the breath or place it on one thing. Our minds tend to be restless. And so the most basic and essential aspect of our meditation practice is the returning to the breath when you realize the mind has wandered. We can also include an observational element. Where was the mind? What did capture our attention? Just to begin to see the habits of mind, the obsessions and areas of anxiety that keep generating thoughts. So even as we return to the breath, we also see the kind of inventory our own mind, we don't have to do anything special with this. We don't have to analyze it or add in judgments, more thoughts. The seeing alone What's revealed? Will naturally bring about an insight and understanding. Even though our minds are complex, much of what we do with our thinking is quite simple, really primal expressions of desire and aversion, expressions of fear. And all of that is quite natural. Again, not to be judged or rejected, just to see clearly. And when we get into the habit of returning to the breath and to the present moment, we're cultivating our own capacity to guide our attention, to not be completely under the sway of these mental impulses. We are learning to let go. Before I talk more Dharma, I just want to, this comment about kind of trying to make this an uplifting period of the year. I've talked a little bit about how I sort of dread November, that somehow it's like the beginning of winter and the winter mind states. But I was also reflecting on how this is, also a time when there can be a lot of positive things, certainly like family and, Thanksgiving and or community, and it's a time when it's a great time of year to go on retreat or do spiritual practice. My first retreat was over at Thanksgiving. 5-day Thanksgiving retreat back in 1980, and when I got sober, I just remember how in December I would start to go to more meetings, and that the strength of community was just really rich and joyful, really. And so just encouraging everybody to take care of yourselves and look for opportunities to find some enriching activities in your life. There you go. It's a public service announcement. As we were sitting, and sort of guiding this and thinking about how this practice works. It's something, these things that I obviously think about a lot and try to communicate. The observing the mind part of this practice, observing the thought patterns, the importance of that, one of the sort of ironies of how meditation is talked about and understood is that people often think of it as I need to stop thinking, or I'm supposed to stop thinking. But that means that you don't get to see your thoughts. And if you don't see your thoughts, there's a lot you miss and a lot you don't understand about what's going on internally, because our thoughts are the things that trigger our behaviors and our emotions. And, if we just try to get away from them and suppress them, we never see the patterns that are being established and that are playing out through our thoughts. So it's a way into our life. It's the way into our mind. If Joseph Goldstein used to quote his teacher Munindraji saying, if you want to understand your mind, sit down and watch it. And I was thinking about how that I think of that as a kind of meditative inventory, to use the 12-step language. And then I was thinking about how, this is, I suppose, one of the reasons why I started doing this work and why I continue to do it, that the 12 steps don't mention this. I mean, the 12-step literature, of course, does talk about our minds and the thoughts that we that are, unhelpful and destructive. But the steps themselves, starting from step four, focus on, our behavior essentially, and the ways our behavior manifests, our failings, our moral, searching and fearless moral inventory, the shortcomings. Step six and seven talk about defects of character and shortcomings, but they don't specifically sort of point to the mind. It's more like try to act better, try to behave better, and obviously that's a really valuable thing and an important part of recovery, but it doesn't really get at the roots of addiction, which are in the mind. And to understand the mind, we sit down and watch the mind. And it's not just that we look at the thoughts that arise, because the mind is more than thoughts, even though that's, again, sort of one of the simplistic ways that we maybe talk about our mind. But the mind includes emotions, and it includes these elements that the Buddha talks about of the feeling tone of our mental experience, as well as our physical experience. But the mental tone of our, the feeling tone of our mental experience, the way our mind labels things and names things, or perceives things, understands things, the impulses and volition that comes about through the mind and consciousness itself. These are, four of the five aggregates: the feeling, tone, perception, mental formations, consciousness. The fifth one is the form, is body. And so, but when we start to meditate, the grossest form of mental activity is thoughts, and so that's the thing we can start to look at and see. And as I say, that can be very revealing. You start to realize that you obsess a lot about this, or that you worry about that, something really unnecessary. Like one of my examples is that I realized some years ago that every time I was planning a trip, I spent 2 weeks packing my suitcase in my mind, and just seeing that, literally seeing, like being meditating and going, oh, I'm doing that again. And finally realizing I was doing it, because it was going on unconsciously. I wasn't aware that I was doing it. And then finally realizing I was doing it was like, I don't have to plan everything. I mean, it's good, to think about, okay, you're going to a different climate. Maybe you need to go to the store and pick up, some other garment or something. But I don't need to spend my 45-minute meditation period thinking about what clothing I'm going to wear in 2 weeks, and that's just a trivial example, but our minds are quite trivial to a great extent, and there's a lot of energy that we waste. But more importantly, it's to notice, well, what's that about, right? And that's a pretty simple example, that obviously it's about anxiety. And it took me a long time to realize that I have this anxiety about travel. It's like, okay, and what does that feel like, right? Because it's more than just thoughts. It's an energy in the body, and it's the nervous system. And how can I respond to that? Do I need to, does that have to take me over? So watching the mind is not just watching the words or the literal thoughts in the mind, but it's watching this whole interactive system. And one of the topics I've returned to a great deal lately is the topic of feeling tone, or Vedana. Excuse me for a moment. And I considered this morning giving another talk on that, and because as I was having my early morning meditation, I started thinking about the writing that I want to do on it. So then I thought, well, maybe I'll just talk about this again. But without getting into the whole thing, I picked up Venerable Anālio's book, Bhikkhu Anālio's book, Mindfulness of Breathing. It's on the Anapanasati Sutta, and one area of that sutta addresses feeling tone. And There's one sentence that really stood out for me about working with this, and I'll talk about it, but I'll read the sentence. The simplicity of feeling tone compared to the complexity of other aspects of mental activities makes it easier to observe without getting carried away. So the simplicity of feeling tone as compared to the rest of, other activity, mental activities, makes it easier to observe without getting carried away. The affective dimension of mental activity can become an expedient handle for mindful investigation to get a secure hold on present moment experience without becoming involved in it. So I guess that means I need to sort of explain feeling tone, and the Pali word for it is vedana. Again, you got those who've been around for a while heard about this a lot. And that what the Buddha tells us is that every sense experience is initially received as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, and thinking. Every time our senses are experiencing one of those things, and the mind is considered a sense, then that sense is receiving that experience as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, which is one of the reasons why our minds are very complicated, and it's part of the work of the mind to realize that our mind then is receiving six signals in every moment. It's receiving Vedana through each of our senses constantly. Most of it is neutral. It's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Most of it is neutral, or we'd be overwhelmed, right? And this is one of the things that happens when you're in a highly stimulating environment, that you're receiving too much Vedana and you can't process it. But what is most interesting to me, and pretty apparently to the Buddha as well, is the Vedana, or the feeling tone of the mind, right? And so to realize that every thought is received or known as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and that that pleasant or unpleasant or neutral feeling in the mind then triggers more complex, or how did Anilio put it, more complex mental activities. Because thinking is more complex than just feeling. At least this is how we'd I'll posit that, and I think that's what he is positing, and that all the elements of thinking are more complex than just the affective tone. But the affective tone is what triggers us falling into the things that cause suffering. Because if it's a pleasant affective tone, it triggers craving. If it's an unpleasant affective tone, it triggers aversion. If it's a neutral affective tone, it triggers delusion or non-attention. And desire, aversion, and let's say non-attention are the roots of suffering in Buddhist, theory. And in this is what the Buddha teaches. And so if we're trying to interrupt the arising of suffering, we want to catch the affective tone before triggers this response, the desire, aversion, or non-attention. And that's a particularly fruitful place to look, because the simplicity of feeling tone makes it easier to observe without getting carried away. So what the and this is when the Buddha teaches mindfulness, what's the second foundation of mindfulness? It's feeling tone. So he's saying, pay attention to your body and pay attention to feeling tone. And if you are able to just be with feeling tone and breathe with it and feel it, then it won't have to proliferate into thinking or into the grasping. This requires training for, I would say, for two main reasons. One of the main reasons it requires training is because ordinarily we aren't even aware of feeling tone as a distinct aspect of experience. We might feel it as part of, I'm feeling crummy, or I'm feeling excited, or I'm feeling anxious, but that's what we're talking about, an emotion there, really, more of a complex mental activity. But to just feel the raw, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral quality of things is something we have to learn how to do. It's not instinctive, it's not intuitive, it's not something that even in our culture we know exists. It's not the this is like one of those genius aspects of the Buddha, that he is able to parse out the distinct elements of experience and show that there's this aspect of experience that ordinarily is completely ignored because we're swept along by the energy, right? We're swept along by the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral quality of it. And we're not paying attention to it, the pleasantness of it. We're paying attention to the thing itself. I'm not paying attention to the pleasant aspect of chocolate ice cream. I'm paying attention to the creamy, sweet, rich part of it, And that's not the affective tone, that's the flavor. Flavor is different from the pleasant quality of it. But in this Buddhist framework, the flavor isn't really important, which is really kind of striking to me, because I think the ordinary, unenlightened worldlings, as the Buddha calls us, we think the flavor is what it's all about. The Buddha's like, yeah. No, not, don't. That's not what you need to notice. Notice the pleasantness and notice how it's what it's triggering. So this is the first challenge of working with Vedana, is just finding it, noticing it, separating it out. And my experience is that you can't get rid of everything else and just be absorbed in Vedana. No, I shouldn't say you can't, but that's difficult. Essentially, what happens is that the flavor recedes a little bit, the flavor of the experience. And I'm using flavor now as more of a metaphor than a literal term, because I'm suggesting that seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, and smelling, and thinking, all each of them has a flavor. So I'm using it as a metaphor, rather than the literal flavor I was talking about before. So we have to learn to, so the flavor can kind of recede as we try to pay more attention to the affective tone. Now that flavor is complex. It's got, with the five physical senses, it's got a physical quality to it, so it's part of form. But then it's got a history, memory, it's got an identity, and it's got impulses, which with in a story, very particularly with mental experiences, it's quite complex. So that's all kind of going on, and we try to like pull out and highlight the affective tone. So that's the first thing we have to do to be able to just find it at all, and that can take a while. Get to work. The other aspect that makes it difficult to develop mindfulness of Vedana, of affective tone, is that it's we are there there from I don't know if I can speak of all humans, but many people, and I speak for myself, and I think this is probably true of a lot of people with addictions or recovering from addictions. Many people are afraid to feel anything. We talk about being afraid of feeling emotions, but the affective tone is like the raw material of emotions. And so to even touch into particularly the aversive feeling tone is we instinctively move away from it. So we have to learn both to see it at all and then to let go of the fear of feeling it. So this is a process. This is not something that we just do by, oh, I read I should do this, or Kevin said I should do that. I just, it's like you have to get the idea in your head, and then you have to start to work on it. And it's a process. And you'll if you make it a theme in your life, so it's not just when you're meditating, but you make it a theme in your life to kind of keep asking that question. What's the affective tone? Gradually, it'll reveal itself. And most of the time, at least in the beginning, you only can be aware of the Vedana in retrospect. That is to say, you find yourself caught up in wanting something or not wanting something. You find yourself caught up in desire or aversion, and then you remember, oh wait, there's Vedana behind this. What was the Vedana that triggered this desire or this aversion or this spacing out? Although it's hard to catch yourself spacing out. And you go, oh, it was that sound, it was that smell, it was that taste, it was that thought, it was that memory, that triggered it. But there was a quality to it. There was an unpleasant or a pleasant or a neutral quality to it. And so we start this process by looking back, like how did I get here? And then with time, we can cultivate this mindfulness in our meditation so that we're actually feeling the feeling tone in real time. And that's, again, as I say, the four foundations of mindfulness are body, feeling tone, mental states or mind states, and what's called phenomena, or this Dharma teachings, insights, I like to think of them. So one fourth of what the Buddha thinks we should pay attention to, that at least a quarter of our attention should be on Vedana. And so, since most of us don't even know what that is and have to learn what it is and learn how to feel it, we can see that it's a very demanding aspect of practice, a very challenging aspect of practice. I guess I find it particularly intriguing because of that, opaque quality to it. I guess opaque might be exactly the right word, but this quality that it's like hidden. We can't really see it. We're blind to it. And Because it's easier to say, oh, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of breath makes perfect sense. Mindfulness of mental states or mindfulness of thoughts, okay, I get what that is. But mindfulness of feeling tone is something unusual and not familiar to most of us. So, I hope that was useful. It feels like I am really in this process of kind of sorting out how to communicate this and communicate about this quality as I think about writing about it. And so I appreciate your patience in listening. And I hope it's pointing towards something that you find useful. So thank you for your attention. And we have some time left for comments or questions. I'm gonna lean in a little bit. Since I've been just talking to space.
Hi, Kevin. I have my hand up. I don't know if you can
Yeah,
see.
Joni, hi.
Okay. I'm not sure how much you can see on the screen, so I don't want to make assumptions that you can see. I seem to be more blind to the neutral aspects of the feeling tones, and I don't really, I really never gave it a whole lot of thought, whether that lack of realization, how it affects me, and I don't know how to look at it, I guess is what I'm saying. It's neutral. I'm just kind of like, eh, and I don't care. And is it? I'm concerned now because I know I sh you know I should say should, but I want to be more aware of when those feelings happen. Of neutrality, what does that mean? What is, am I ignoring things? I want to have some curiosity around it. What are your thoughts on
Yeah, great
that?
question, Joni. Thank you. The something Anallio says, and I'm pretty sure it's in this book, really struck me on that topic when he says that neutral feeling tone tends to trigger fantasy, kind of spacing out, because it's essentially boredom. We're bored, and so we try to generate. We kind of generate something. So again, it's like something we see more in retrospect. Like when you realize, oh, like I'm. Why am I fantasizing about that? Like, why am I planning my Hawaiian vacation that I am not going to go on, or whatever, And you realize, oh, I was just bored. Nothing was happening. And reading that from him answered a question I've often had that of something that happens on meditation retreats, how I can get to a place where I'm very concentrated and everything's really peaceful. And it's just like settled and like the retreat is going really well. And then my mind just goes right off and trips out into dreams and can't, what I'm going to do after the retreat and all blah, 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 and all this stuff. And I always ask myself, why, when I'm in this pleasant, quiet state, does my mind completely go off? Why won't my mind just be happy to be there? And it's because it's a relatively neutral state. There's not much going on. There's no drama. So our minds kind of seek out stimulation. And when there isn't much stimulation, we create it. It's like we know, like there's that, the kind of people who create drama in their lives. People who don't have any problems, don't really have any problems, but they're somehow they're always finding problems, I mean, and of course we all do this to some degree, so that's what I understand about it, that it's tied up with It triggers this kind of wish for something to happen, and so I don't know if that's helpful, but something to notice.
Yeah, that is helpful. Thank you. It explains why I am always seeking entertainment.
Yeah,
I'm always
exactly.
designing something or painting something in my mind or thinking.
Yeah. And so-called smartphones are the addiction to smartphones is that fear of the neutral experience, if you will. I don't know if we call it fear, but yeah, it is fear because that feeling like, oh man, I'm gonna have to sit here and do nothing for the next 5 minutes. Quick, grab my phone, Yeah. Steve, go ahead.
Well, I found this to be an incredibly compelling conversation or idea that you had, and man, it's being a food addict. Something came across when you were talking about that difference between the feeling tone around the taste and the
Yeah.
pleasure, as opposed to, and I've never really looked at my food addiction in that way. I started to think to myself, well, there's a useful tool. As I've developed my practice and I've been meditating every day for a couple of hours in the morning and been studying quantum physics, and I'm just trying to feel that energy from the source to, because my mind goes to food constantly. It's just this constant, this craving thing. And, so what's that about? Where can I find that neutral feeling or that neutral tone to kind of stopgap that? I mean, the studying I'm doing, it says when those cravings come, you just tell yourself to stop. And so I'm just curious as how can we put our minds into that state, into that stop state where you're in that neutral, I mean, I'm not even sure what the hell I'm saying here, but I found it very compelling to think about the way you phrased that.
Yeah, I think the first thing is that we have to learn to be with the feeling, because the action that in as you're describing, the eating is a reaction to the feeling, and it's a effort to get away from the feeling and to create a different feeling, right? And so the practice says what we need to do is the stopping is really stopping moving forward, but it involves staying. It's like with the dog, right? Stay with this feeling. And the meditation, the tool of meditation that we have for holding feelings is the breath. So the breath helps us to physically open the chest, open the belly, open the feeling areas of the body. And then as we breathe, we release tension. The opening gives space with the in-breath, and the breathing out gives a release of energy and a settling of that. Of the feeling energy of the nervous system that's been activated by the craving. And so but as I was talking about, the first thing is we have to learn how to feel it, but also to not react to the fear of the feeling. That's the thing. As soon as you turn toward the feeling, you're going to sense a an aversion, a sense of like, oh God, okay, oof. And that, but we can do that. We can be with unpleasant feelings, which one of the things that meditation actually trains us in, that when we learn to just sit and breathe and the mind wanders, we get agitated, but we keep sitting, we learn not to move, right? And to literally not move physically, but also not to move with the mind to or to try to do something with it. And we learn to let go and to come back and be with, this is just how it is right now. I'm just going to feel this. It's unpleasant or it's pleasant, but I'm not going to do anything with it. And so that training helps us when we turn directly to the feeling tone and breathe and say, oh God, this again. All right. Okay, I'll just be with it. It's okay. And the non-resistance to it actually gives it the space to dissipate when we act on it, when we react to it, we feed it, and we give it more power and more energy, and it creates that cycle, that repetitive cycle. The more you act out of fear, the more fearful you're going to be, right? And the what less you act out of fear, the less fearful you're going to be. And it's just that karmic cycle that we have to engage. And it takes courage. It's why they call this sometimes it's called the path of a warrior,
Right. Well, that's very beneficial, and I just have to learn to do that when I'm not meditating. I think I'm
Right.
making very serious progress. Thank you for that, Kevin.
Thanks, Steve. Deborah, hello.
Morning, Kevin.
Hi.
Thank you for identifying the fear factor. That was really helpful to me. The few times that I've been able to identify the fact that I've had Vedna and felt curiosity to go there and explore, I've always felt like, oh, that's being frivolous. And I
Seen
shouldn't
what?
come back.
I haven't. No, sorry. Look for that.
Sorry, someone got
Anyway,
unmuted.
so I came back to the breath, and but now I realize it was probably out of fear that I did that, and with good reason. And so I should just say, put on, my big girl panties and really explore, because that's, part of my path is to, be unafraid now. And so identifying my fear factor is a big thing. And so thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. But I do want to say, that we have to be careful in this stuff. We're not just throw ourselves into, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do now. I'm gonna face it. These energies, the power of the Vedana, which is deeply conditioned in us and can be tied up with trauma and history that can't be just we can't just open up that Pandora's box. It's so we need to really take care with that. If we're finding a lot of resistance or a lot of triggering, we need to approach it very carefully and probably with a professional, with a therapist. As this is just I've been reading, The Body Keeps a Score, and this is very much what they're talking about in there, that these energies, sometimes spirituality we try to make things into like, oh, just do this, and then let it go or whatever, and the understanding that a lot of the Dharma world, as well as the psychology and neuroscience world, has come to is it's not always that simple or that safe to just dive in. I would be careful in pulling on the big girl underwear there. Approach it carefully. Make sure they're clean before whatever. So I don't know. There's no metaphor I have for that. So we'll just let it go. Last comment from Charles. Hi. There you go. I still can't hear you for some reason. Is your microphone turned down by any chance? Okay, do you want to type in something into the chat or maybe? While you're doing that, I will just say, I will be back next Tuesday, and then okay, all right. I'm sorry about that. Drop a line if you like. I'm just about to post. In fact, I may have posted it yet. I'm not sure if I completed this on my website, but our the February retreat in Northern California, we're ready to start taking registration by the end of the week. And so, if you're interested in going on a 5-day meditation retreat with me and Joni, who's here today, and Greg Pergament, our Qigong teacher, you'll be able to register for that in the next few days. And and if you're on my mailing list, you'll hear about that. And I'll be talking about it on here in the coming weeks. So, and many of you I know have been long and will come, and you'll hear directly from us. If you've been on the retreat before, you'll get an invitation. So thank you all for coming today. Great to hang out and talk Dharma and recovery. And don't drink or use no matter what. And keep
Thanks, Kevin.
meditating.
Thanks,
All right,
Kevin.
you guys, everybody take care.
Thank you, Kevin. Looking
Yep.
forward to that retreat. I'm already
Yeah.
signed up.
Oh, good.
Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, okay.
Bye, everybody. Thanks, Kevin.
All right, bye-bye.
Yeah, great talk.
All
Thanks,
right,
Kevin.
Mike, thanks, man. Nice to see you, Abigail.